This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most of us are surrounded by music in our daily lives, even when we're not aware of it. Why, we just played a six-second piece of music to start this program. And today's show will deal with music, however, for more than 6 seconds. Later, we're going to hear from a man who has played with some of the biggest names in the music business. He hasn't been in Charlotte for over 2 decades, but David Bromberg is back tonight and in our studio later this hour. First, though, we meet some folks who want to help young people, children, even infants, start their musical education. They're from an organization called Kinder Music. They say children thrive on music, that it's one of the best vehicles for learning in early childhood development. They also claim that what they teach is proven to improve a child's brain development. Well, we thought that was worth looking into, and we've invited some Kinder musicians to join us. Betsy Gursky is the owner of Music for Life, which she opened in 2009, and she's been involved in Kinder music for quite a bit longer than that. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Joining us by phone is Carol Penny, Director of Education for Kinder Music International. She's been teaching music to children for over 40 years, began with Kinder Music in 1982, and served as lead trainer of Kinder Music's Outstanding Educator Training Program and Manager of Curriculum Development. Nice to have you here as well.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And also with us in our studio, Susan Hamill, the mother of 2 Kinder Music graduates. How old? Actually, 3 Kinder Music graduates,
That's
I come
right.
to find out. How old are they?
I have one son almost 17, I have one son 14, and a daughter that is almost 11.
And we'll find out what they're up to and what kind of music they're into, if they're still into music, in a few minutes here. Kinder music literally means children's music, and it got started in this country, I think, in the late 70s, based on a program that started in Germany in the 60s. You begin with children who are infants. And Carol, you've been doing this a long time. So are you teaching them to play instruments at that age? They're too small.
Right. Well, at a very early age, they can begin to shake. That's one of their action schemes for exploring the world around them. So put an egg shaker in their hand or a rattle. Rattles have been around forever. So infants have been playing musical instruments for a long time. It's just that they have to be developmentally appropriate for what they can do physically with their muscles. So we find the right instrument for the developmental stage. So, yeah, I guess they are. Maybe someday we'll have an egg shaker concerto.
I don't want to get bogged down in infants because I know you work with children who are older than that. But I'm just curious, when you're dealing with an infant and maybe they have a rattle in their hand, are you trying to get them to move it in time with music, or what?
Well, an ultimate goal later on when it's developmentally appropriate, which is not at the infant stage, for them to be able to match their beat to an external sound source, that will happen. But it all comes back to the experiences they have when they're really young. So one of the ways they're going to feel the beat is they're going to do a lot of things with bouncing on mommy's or daddy's or nanny's or grandma's lap. So they're going to feel the beat while they're hearing the music. So no, we're not expecting they themselves are keeping the beat at this stage, but we're surrounding them with sounds and with opportunities to feel the beat by dancing, by bouncing in laps, by a parent tapping on their tummies or on their legs. And they begin to get that hearing, feeling sensation that later translates in being able to keep the beat.
Susan, at what age did your children become involved with Kinder music?
All of them began the program around 18 months.
Wow.
And
what were you expecting at 18 months?
I really did not know with my first child.
So why did you take them? If you had no expectations.
I took music. I played the piano for 13 years and so grew to have an appreciation for music and had a wonderful experience with that. And so I wanted my children to be exposed to it. It was offered at my church when we lived in Dothan, Alabama. And so I thought, well, let me try this. I was a stay-at-home mom at the time. And so I tried that with my first son and loved the way that the program allowed the children to physically move, to feel the music, and to understand how music works and to appreciate it from there, more than just sitting and trying to learn a skill.
So, Betsy, when you get somebody who's 18 months old, a child who's 18 months old, what do you do with them? I'm just really curious about this.
Well, we meet in groups, and their parents are with them. Their parents are their primary educational force at that age. So we do a lot of coaching of parents to relax and play. A lot of the activities are very natural and instinctive for parents, but sometimes it doesn't come so naturally for a parent. And I might need to work with a parent a little bit more toward reaching a more playful place with their child, because that's really the crux of what is happening with education all the way through age seven.
You're teaching parents how to play with their children in some ways, and also increasing the amount of play time, because in today's world that seems to have diminished a lot.
Yes, there's, I think, a whole missing piece in society that we used to get from our elders and extended communities, where folk songs, spontaneous activity with our children used to fill the hours. Mm. And now I have parents on a daily basis that are just grateful to have scheduled time to interact with their children. And so in bringing a musical environment to that and all of the benefits that the child has to gain through that, and we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, the input of the musical learning, but have the parent learn how to do that in a natural way, you're giving them a real gift in their parenting.
And Mike, the environment that Betsy creates and Kinder Music creates is so joyful. And for children, that's the beginning.
Yes, I read that over and over yesterday.
That's the
beginning.
When
I read outside opinions of this program, the word joy came up a lot from people. Explain that.
Well, I think all of us at every age, when we feel joy and happiness, we are motivated and our abilities grow and we feel success and we can have success. And as children, they cannot process those type of thoughts through their mind, but their actions show that. So Kinder Music and Betsy does a super job with this in creating that loving, open, hands-on environment that it makes the parents relax and the children just thrive because they are free to explore with their hands and with their minds and become creative. And in the world today, some of the areas of our life are not allowed that. It's very programmed.
I want to come back to that free to explore thing because music requires structure. It's one thing to be free like a jazz musician, but it seems to me to be a good jazz musician. You have to know the rules so that you can break those rules. We'll come back to that, though. Carol, you are in charge of curriculum and developing curriculum. And this, as I said, started in Germany in the 60s. And the program that happens in this country is slightly different from the way it was in the 1960s in Germany. And it continues to change. I've wondered about this with regard to Sesame Street for years. Why change something that seems to be working when you have a built-in group of young people who are coming in with absolutely no preconceived notions of anything because they're children, and in this case, they're infants? Why do you need to change? Why can't we run Sesame Street from 1970? Would the kids know the difference? Would the kids know the difference if we didn't change your program?
I think we just know more about children's development these days with our ability to see what's going on in their brains. We know more. So we can make the experiences more developmentally appropriate for them. Actually, the programs in Germany started with putting very young children at the keyboard. And while some children thrive getting to a keyboard using fine motor control at a young age, most children don't. It becomes frustrating. How many people have you heard, "I wish my mother had made me take piano"? Well, that says somebody would have had to make me do it in order for me to really enjoy it. What we're trying to do is make it so developmentally appropriate and fun and in a loving, caring environment, as was just said so eloquently, that children want to be involved and that it's done in a way that it does bring joy and not frustration. So the more we learn about children, and of course the world changes, what they're exposed to outside in this environment with technology and everything else, we've got to stay in our curriculum development on the cutting edge so that we understand not just what happens to a child in kinder music class, but what's happening to them in their whole life in our society.
Carol, you've been doing this for 40 years. Betsy, you've been doing this for a while, and you started here in Charlotte under Carol when she was at Queens University. You have a bachelor in music degree, and here you are working with infants to seven-year-olds and slightly older because you have this school of your own called Music.4.Life, which I'm curious about how you came up with that title. But anyway, what have you observed with young people who go through this program? How are they different as a result of having gone through this?
Well, the lifelong love of music that's instilled in these children is really stunning. I mean, I think that Susan's daughter, her youngest of her three, that's 10 years old right now, is an example of motivation, as she spoke of, the love and the naturalness that she's been able to acquire toward learning technique. You and I were talking about before the show, learning technique has all just come very naturally to her. She's playing three instruments, writing her own songs, has just studied voice, yet none of this has come with achievement as being the goal. So in giving her this instilled love of learning, but working with some of the things like that egg shaker with steady beat and working on language as she's older and imagination and all of that, has children's aptitude can be maximized up to age seven. And when we've done that, there's no limits.
So you're laying a foundation with that. Anybody really realizing, the kids don't know it, but they've gotten it through your experience through you.
And I would love to add on to your comment about they don't realize it. Elizabeth Ann finished the kinder music program, and she immediately wanted to start piano with Betsy. So we did. She was in second grade, and you know, I took piano and practiced hours and hours each week, and in a very structured environment. And I had a lot of benefits from that. But about 9 months after she had started piano, I would notice that she wasn't really practicing all the songs that Betsy gave her. She was just playing.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day I finally said to Betsy, we're having this issue, and I don't really know how to handle it, so could you talk to Elizabeth Ann about it? And Betsy, I said, she's just writing music. She's just playing and creating things. Is that okay? And Betsy said, that's okay. And so I said to myself, that's okay. And it has flourished from there.
Yeah. You don't stress performance in kinder music. You emphasize process, I think, over perform. What does that mean?
That the brain working to experience sensory input and sound and rhythm and communication, socializing with others, all of that is doing better things for the child than what would happen if we were to put them at an instrument and critique performance and try to get them on an instrument too soon.
And you have a Bachelor of Music, and we talked about technique before the show, and Susan mentioned a second ago freedom of expression. How do you balance freedom of expression versus the structure that you need if you ultimately want to be able to play an instrument, even rudimentarily well?
Balance the freedom of expression with structure in the classroom, you mean?
Yes. Well, there's the structure of learning how to play an instrument.
We have a curriculum. The structure of the curriculum for 7 years is all, by the time a child is 5 to 7 years old in our class, they are playing dulcimer, recorder, glockenspiel, learning to read notation. There's nothing that's being lost musically along the path of this curriculum.
That's Betsy Gursky is the owner of Music for Life and a kinder music teacher. Carol Penny's with us, the director of education for Kinder Music International, and Susan Hamill, a mother of three children who've gone through the program. We're coming right back, and David Bromberg is just ahead as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Clements Bernard, serving Charlotte and the Southeast for over 25 years, focusing on intellectual property and business litigation matters. Details at worldpatents.com. And Theater Charlotte presenting A Christmas Carol, the Dickens holiday classic with Ebenezer Scrooge and the Ghosts of Christmas Past, Present, and Future, now through Sunday. Tickets at carolinatix.org. You know, things were going so well for the Panthers, at least until Sunday night's primetime embarrassment in New Orleans. We get another chance to play the Saints again in a couple of weeks, but there's a chance that we actually might make the playoffs. First time in a long time. So tomorrow, we're going to talk all things Panthers. We're welcoming back the voice of the Panthers, Mick Mixon, with the Observer's Scott Fowler, and they'll set us straight on the team and its prospects for playoffs tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the so-called Volcker Rule is aimed at reining in risky trading by banks. Details of the proposed new rule and whether it's tough enough to prevent another financial crisis.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Betsy Gursky, Carol Penny, both with Kinder Music, and Susan Hamill, who is the mother of three children who went through the Kinder Music program. Carol, Betsy shared a phrase with us. She says that the fact that children make beautiful music is less important than the fact that music makes beautiful children, which I think is interesting. And you say that the recreational value of music is as valid as the traditional Western European classical model of study, something that Susan went through as a pianist, something that I went through as a child learning music as well. And it's so indoctrinated into me, the way I learned to play and the way we progressed along the from beginner to intermediate player to more advanced and the things that I had to do to get there, that it's hard for me to understand this recreational value of music as something equal to the traditional Western European classical model. So explain it to me.
Can I jump in?
Sure.
So, for instance, there's research that shows just group singing relieves stress hormones. And so right there we have something that tells us that people that are singing with others are going to have less anxiety. And we know that children that are stressed and anxious don't learn as well. So something as simple as being in a group of parents, hearing the human voice and those vibrations that go through the body with others.
And yeah. you work with in the Kinder Music program. You also work outside of that program with young people who are older than 7 years old.
So we do in our school.
So do you change your approach when they get to be older?
We have kind of a non-traditional approach at our school as mm-hmm. well. My husband and I have lessons on all instruments through high school, and we've been able to work with putting kids on different instruments. We have a very boutique kind of centered school where the relationships with our families are very close, and I might have a child that wants to learn a drum beat. We end up with our private lesson children in jam bands, where Elizabeth Ann, Susan's daughter, for instance, has been able to learn all the instruments. So we're about opening doors at our school. If a child is thriving on a particular instrument, they may take that and go into the competitive realm, but we don't stress that. Our first graduate at 18 is majoring in philosophy and math right now and got into Notre Dame. And that was through just a laid-back approach with all the way along.
All right, let's talk about that. Because Carol, Kinder Music says that research shows that children who are consistently engaged by music in age-appropriate ways are helped in their reading and language skills, the spatial and reasoning skills required for math, their social skills are developed, and they develop their physical skills by dancing and playing simple instruments. I heard, and I'm trying to remember right now, I heard this on television last night in a news story, that social skills are developed by people who learn to play music. Why does this happen?
Well, because when we're playing music together, everybody's an important part of the ensemble. So everybody has a role to play. When we come to a basket to get an instrument to play, we take turns. We honor everybody else in the group. It's a wonderful, magical team, and we're working together. And we start at really early ages of beginning to develop that sense of community and responsibility to the community.
Well, what about reading and language skills? Why are they improved? Because I guess you're teaching children how to read music at some point in this program.
Eventually, but there's a study that, Carol, would you tell Mike about the phonological awareness study that was specifically Kinder Music, our school division, that came out this spring?
Right. We did a study that showed children who were involved in this kind of sort of holistic approach to music, where music, as you said in your very introduction, is the vehicle that's used for the total development of the child. When you're in that scenario, rather than the traditional expectation of they're going to learn to play this and I'm going to pound the beat for them and they're going to get the beat, that's coming from externally. When you put it in there and they're joyfully participating with singing and playing instruments and being creative and moving, then when if you were to look at a brain on a scanner at that point, all parts of that brain are alive. It's touching every center of development, the centers that deal with reading, with math, with everything else. In our study, we looked at specifically gains in literacy and vocabulary and understanding, just making gains in their ability to read or understand language, and the gains were significant.
I can see the PSA now. This is your brain. This is your brain on music. Oh. Get it?
Yes. Mike. I love that. That is very, very true.
I would love to give you an example of what I've seen with Elizabeth Ann. Monday night, I picked her up from jam band, and we were on our way home, and I said, so what songs did you guys play tonight? And she started telling me, and I said, what instrument did you play with each song? So she went through it, and she mentioned that they were playing Jingle Bells, and I said, well, what did you instrument did you play with Jingle Bells? She said, the keyboard. She said, but I didn't really have the music. I hadn't practiced it. So I said, what did you do? And she said, I improvised. You know, Mom, improvising means that I just figured it out. And that has stood in my brain since Monday. She just figured it out. That foundation has come from the beginning of Kinder Music. It gives you the ability to expand your brain in that way.
Let me bring Elaine very quickly into this conversation because we're short on time, Elaine. But she's in Huntersville, and I believe you have a graduate. Oh, you are a graduate of Kinder Music. Is that correct, Elaine?
Not of Kinder Music, but of the German program that I believe you mentioned earlier, Orphan Schimbeck.
Okay.
It starts with children that are very young at the toddler age, and it was a very small program here in Charlotte run by a gentleman named Chuck, and I wish I could remember his last name, but it was at one of the larger churches downtown, and it was something that I enjoyed so very much, but I had no idea how much it would impact my life. As I grew older, I went into choirs and other sorts of musical things. When I went into my teenage years, music had become a language for me that I could speak when normal speech language wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a teenager and my hormones were going crazy, I could sit and I could sing, and it would express all of these emotions and things inside of me that were so hard to get out.
And this is a story that I'm sure you've heard time and time and time again, correct?
It gets in there where other things can't. Music just does. We work with a lot of special needs kids, and they really do thrive.
Elaine, thank you for your call. Very quickly, because we're really short on time, all these programs cost money. Is this who has access to these kinds of programs, to Kinder Music?
We're in our own business as educators. Lots of us have scholarship programs. Our school at Music for Life is very community-based with different types of outreach going on. But we do have our parents do pay, you know, that are in our studio programs. Mm-hmm. Kinder Music has a very large outreach effort called the Ruth Anderson Scholarship Fund, where they raise money for kids that are underprivileged.
So. And I'm just curious, Carol, this is the international program is based in Greensboro, is that right?
That's right. That's our international headquarters.
How can that be? Why not Charlotte? I mean, why is it North Carolina?
Well, actually, when the program first came over from Germany, it actually came to Greensboro just by a series of coincidences. And so we've always felt like that has been home. And it's a wonderful city, too.
I want to close with Susan Hamill, who has a son named Forrest, who started with Kinder Music at 18 months. William started at 24 months. I think Elizabeth Ann followed a similar path.
Around 18 months.
Do they all still play music?
They do. Forrest is currently playing the baritone at the upper school at Charlotte Country Day. William played the trumpet through seventh grade. And Elizabeth Ann currently plays piano and guitar with Betsy and John.
Do they have musical aspirations? Do you want them to have musical aspirations?
I know that Elizabeth Ann does. She talks with John about being her agent and her father being her money manager and all those kind of things. So, yes, it's just endless.
And even if they don't go on to have musical careers, what will this have done for them?
You know, this opens their brain up to be out of the box, to be creative, and to be able to attack the world and to figure things out and not be so structured.
Susan Hamill's a mother of three Kinder Music graduates. Carol Penny's the Director of Education for Kinder Music International. She joined us by phone from Greensboro, where they are still wrestling with why not relocating the program here. And Betsy Gursky is owner of Music for Life, a Kinder Music program, and more. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Several of Kinder Music's graduates over the years pursued their musical studies and have gone on to prominence, as we've talked about, in the business. David Bromberg isn't one of them, but he could have been, had Kinder Music been around when he was a child. But Bromberg has done okay, despite that deficiency in his resume. He's been in and out of the music business for decades and has played with Bob Dylan, the Beastie Boys, George Harrison, Emmylou Harris, Doc Watson, Jerry Garcia, Pete Seeger, Dr. John, Willie Nelson, and on and on and on. He's followed up his Grammy-nominated 2007 CD, Try Me One More Time, with one he released this fall, Only Slightly Mad, and he's in town to share some of his music tonight.
They say that no man is an island, but times we all stand alone. But friends can help with a heartache. You heal your soul on your own. I've no strength to fight. But I'll rise again. I may be down. I may be down this evening. But I know I'm going to rise again. Because I've been down in that pit when it seemed like it had no bottom. And I'm sure we've all seen that pit. Maybe for some of us, it's not as deep as for others. But for some of us, it's so deep, it looks like there's no way out. But I believe there's a way out for everyone. It could be religion, it could be therapy, it could be running, it could be music. There are even hotlines, there's ways to get out. You just have to keep looking for the ways out. This is a beautiful world, and it's a privilege to live in it. Live in it.
David Bromberg was last in town, I think, 22 years ago. Welcome back to Charlotte, and welcome to the program. Nice to meet you.
It's good to meet you. Thank you.
You know, in that song, you sound a little bit like a revivalist preacher, and you also sound like a guy who's trying to convince himself that he will rise again. What's the story behind that tune?
It goes pretty far back. A lot of my guitar playing I learned from a man named Reverend Gary Davis, who was around the Greensboro, Raleigh, you know, around those three towns.
Really?
In the 30s. And he came to New York City, mm-hmm. which is where I met him. I studied guitar with him. At first, I paid him for the lessons, but gradually it got to the point where instead of paying him, I would be like a seeing eye dog for him. He was blind. Uh-huh. And I'd take him to churches. And I grew to love the church. I spent more time in churches than any Jewish boy you've ever met. I learned an awful lot, not only about the guitar, but I learned a lot about the guitar even from hearing different preachers. If you listen to a musician like, say, B.B. King, mm-hmm. Who has said many times that the tone that he gets, he's trying to emulate the tone of a guy named Lonnie Johnson, who was a virtuoso of the 30s and 40s and 50s. And I can hear that. And his choice of notes is his own. But his phrasing is very different than the phrasing of Eric Clapton and all the rock and roll players. His phrasing comes from the church. His phrasing is a preacher's phrasing. He uses rests, pauses, in order to make you wait for the next note.
Yes. Wow. And you learn that in church just by listening?
Yeah, sure. The phrasing the preachers use.
Yeah. You mentioned you met, I've forgotten his name already, I'm sorry.
Reverend Gary Davis?
Yes. You met him in New York, and you had gone to New York. Where are you from originally?
Well, I don't know what original is. I was born in Philadelphia. I was raised in Westchester County. I went to Columbia University in New York City.
And you gravitated toward what, the village scene in the 1960s, which was still kind of folky, wasn't it, back then?
Yes. It was during the folk scare.
Yeah.
We survived it, though. We did.
And you ended up playing with everyone. I mean, it's remarkable. When I went through the list of people that you have played with or for or who have used your music, because you didn't really play with the Beastie Boys.
No.
They sampled you.
That's right.
And put it in. And that doesn't bother you?
No. No. They, as a matter of fact, it was very interesting. At the time, it was on their second LP. Mm-hmm. That's how long ago it was. And at that time, it wasn't necessary to pay someone for sampling them. Mm-hmm. But they sent me a letter saying they wanted to pay me. And we had an agreement, and I signed it. And when I mailed it back, they asked for an autographed picture. I was very, very surprised. And they paid me very well for that.
Yeah. But you've played – I mentioned a bunch of people that you sang – that you've played with over the years. But you let me name a few more. Linda Ronstadt.
Yes. Linda's a good friend.
Los Lobos.
Yes.
Phil Lesh.
Yeah.
Jerry Jeff Walker.
Mm-hmm.
John Prine.
Mm-hmm.
Phoebe Snow.
Yes. Phoebe was a good friend.
Yeah, but these are all very different kinds of music.
Yeah. Well, I play a lot of different kinds
of
music.
I know you do.
I finally learned that it was commercial suicide. Because back in the day when there were record stores, which is when I was first active, they didn't know what bin to put my records in, and the record company didn't know what magazines to advertise me in and or what radio stations to try to convince to play my music, because I play whatever I like.
Yeah.
I always thought that if what I do becomes popular, I have a corner on the market.
I started in this business working for a middle-of-the-road radio station, uh-huh. something that does not exist anymore,
no.
MOR.
Yeah.
But you were all over the road.
Yeah.
And that,
yeah,
that's right. That was the problem.
Yeah.
Because I remember seeing your albums.
Uh-huh.
I was either in college radio or right after that. I remember seeing your albums in the library, and people were playing them.
Yeah.
But they were playing them on all these different – we had different kinds of shows on college radio.
Uh-huh.
And you'd be heard on every different kind of show there was.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In a way, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I got no complaints.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and hear more of Dave Bromberg's music and more of our conversation with David Bromberg. So stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Starving Artist Productions presenting The Birth, a locally grown Christmas production inspired by the works of Frederick Buechner, tomorrow through the 21st at Duke Energy Theater. Tickets available at thebirth.net and historic Brattonsville Christmas Candlelight Tours. Christmas in colonial and antebellum Carolina backcountry, costumed interpreters, and holiday activities. Saturday, 3 till 9 p.m. chmuseums.org. The so-called Volcker Rule is aimed at reining in risky trading by banks. Details on the new rule and whether it's tough enough to prevent another crisis, the topic of the conversation, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Reem Show. We continue our conversation with David Bromberg, who's appearing tonight at the Visual Light Theater on Elizabeth Avenue. Stay with us.
When you make your year-end contributions to organizations that are important to you, we hope you have WFAE on your list. Listener support is critical to help us continue to bring you the news and information programs that you enjoy. Make your pledge, and you're also entered to win a MacBook Air. No gift is necessary to win, but we hope you will make a tax-deductible investment at 704-549-9000 or WFAE.org. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Bromberg is our guest, a man NPR calls a master instrumentalist. His latest CD, which came out this fall, is called Only Slightly Mad, and he appears tonight at 8 at the Visual Light Theater on Elizabeth Avenue, the first time he's been in town in about 22 years. We were talking just before the break about how your music was kind of all over the road. You found it difficult and more interesting to make albums that had music from different genres all over them, so no one knew how to categorize you, which was right. A problem back in the days where there were music stores, because, as you say, they didn't know which bin to put your record in.
Right.
And you tried, during the break, you were just starting to tell me a story about trying to do an album of all Chicago blues.
Right. I decided I was going to do a blues album, and on the CD before this latest one, it was called Use Me, because I called up a bunch of artists and asked each of them to write a song for me and then to produce me doing that song, Use Me. I had tracks with Los Lobos and John Hyatt and Vince Gill and Linda Ronstadt and Dr. John and Keb Mo and Levon Helm, who was an old friend. And at the time, Levon was recovering from some throat surgery, so he couldn't talk, let alone produce. But the guy who led his band was Larry Campbell, and Larry produced the sessions. And one of the tunes that we did was kind of a straight-ahead Chicago blues. He did such a fantastic job. So I asked him if he'd produce an album of Chicago blues for me. He said, well, he'd love to produce an album of mine. He's a Grammy-winning producer, he said. But, I mean, he is a Grammy-winning producer. But he said, let's do an old-fashioned David Bromberg album with everything on it. So we did.
Which is was that the one before Only Slightly Mad or Only Slightly Mad?
Well, Only Slightly Mad is the one that was produced by in its entirety by Larry Campbell. He produced the two tracks with Levon on Use Me.
And I'm going to play a song that you wrote with your wife Nancy Josephson, and your producer Larry Campbell is playing steel guitar on this track. It's called "You've Got to Mean It Too." This is a love song. And you wrote it because your wife asked you to. I'm going to ask you about that, but first let's hear part of this tune. This is David Bromberg.
This guy I know was on TV telling people how to live. He sure had a lot to say, but not a lot to give. Look, those are real fine words. Step back and look at what you do. You know it's not enough to say things. You've gotta mean them too. I heard Laurie sing last night. Time in 20 years, she sang me all her own songs, near brought me to tears, and she sang straight from the heart, like all great singers do. She knows it's not enough to say things. Gotta mean them too. It's a thing you teach your children. You know they learn from watching you. It's all in how you do things. You've got to mean them too. a thing you teach your children. You know they learn from watching you. It's all in how you do things. You've got to mean them too. I'll tell you why I wrote this song. Folks, I wrote it for my wife. And she's always stayed beside me while I played blind man's buff with life. And every time we touch her kiss, each time that I say I love you, and every time that we make love, with all my soul, I mean it too.
We rarely play the entire piece of music, but I wanted to play all of this. That's David Bromberg from his latest CD, Only Slightly Mad. You've Got to Mean It Too is the name of it. It's a love song. You wrote it with your wife, but it's a love song to your wife.
I didn't really write it with my wife. I wrote it by myself.
Okay, but she sings on it.
She sings on
it. Okay. And she asked you to write it, right?
Well, not exactly. She one day observed, and she was very emphatic that that's what happened, and it is what happened. She observed that I hadn't written any love songs, and so when I started this one, I had no idea where it was going.
Yeah,
you know, that's where it went.
Well, you call it quirky. Why is it quirky?
Because there's only one verse about love.
Hmm.
The first verse is about a guy I know who's a bit of a hypocrite.
Hmm.
The second verse is about a woman I know, Lori Lewis, who's a brilliant singer and songwriter who really means everything she does. And the last verse is about my relationship with my wife.
Yeah, when you get to the relationship, it is tender and sweet and sincere and deep. And I'm curious as to why it took you so long to get to that point. Why the other two sections of the song? Or do you even know why?
I have no idea. That's the way the song came out. It just, it took me there.
You are, we talked about Larry Campbell, who was the producer of that song and that whole CD, Only Slightly Mad, but you've been a music producer yourself. So why did you want somebody else to produce your work when you've done producing for other big name people?
Well, producing a record is like directing a movie. You make the decisions. And when I produced my own albums, it was 18 hours in a room with no windows.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd done enough of those. It's such hard work.
What's a producer do?
Well, pretty much everything except performing, except that I used to produce my own records. But mm-hmm. The producer selects the studio, cooperates with the artist in selecting the material. He has a say in it.
Mm-hmm.
Selects the musicians, selects which to do first, how long to spend on it, which is the right take, how to guide what's going on in the studio. That's a little fast, or I want you to put more of yourself into this, or as I've had some producers say, give me that Andre Segovia, Eric Clapton feel. You know what I mean.
And do you?
No. But the only answer is, oh, yeah, I got that.
<That's>, of course.
Yeah, that's the only thing.
And then if you don't get it, let's try that again.
Yeah.
One more time.
Yeah.
You produced Carly Simon's demo.
Yeah.
That's way back.
Yeah, way back.
And you also produced what was for a while a pretty famous album and one that became important in the John Hartford catalog called Aeroplane. You were the producer. He asked you to produce it, and you really took total charge of that project.
Well, that was his idea. He said that he didn't want to hear, nor did he want any of the other musicians to hear any playbacks until it was he didn't want to hear note one until it was mixed and sequenced, was what he told me. So I produce it in a vacuum. You know, usually you do a take and you say, come on in, guys, take a listen to this. And the guys say, well, I could play that part better. I could do this part better. But it was all on me.
Why did he want to do it that way?
Because he didn't want to interrupt the flow of playing.
You have been doing this for a long time. You were a very much in-demand session player, which is that, and people, these are unsung heroes of the recording industry, because these are the people that are brought in to really play. There was a period of time when a lot of rock bands, like the Beach Boys and others, would go into a studio, and they were not really the musicians that you heard on the record. They would bring in people who could really knock it out in a take or two because they were superb musicians. You're one of those people. How did that happen?
I don't know. People liked what I did. Well, look, I guess the best way to explain it is that when I was in my 20s, I had a direct connection. What I mean by that is that it seemed to me as though the music was coming from somewhere else and just coming through my hands. Mm. I would pick up a guitar and it would come out. And so people used to hire me to play on their records. And I played on an awful lot of the records that you were just describing, especially on Mercury. They had all these groups that didn't exist, Steam, Archie's, The Left Bank, you know.
And oh, my God, The Left Bank?
Yeah. Eventually there was a group, The Left Bank, but the original record was studio musicians. So we just get called in with a bunch of guys you might have met before and you might not have. And
why did they do that? Why did they just create these things out of thin air as opposed to finding a group?
Because they didn't have to pay royalties to the group.
Ah, because you were paid for the session and that's it.
Yes, exactly. And then if I don't know if they had any part of the group's later.
So when you come together and you are suddenly the Left Bank or you're suddenly the Archies, how do you know what you're supposed to do?
You do what you know how to do, and if you can, you follow the producer's directions. Mm-hmm. But, this isn't all that unusual. There was a wonderful singer, a backup singer, during the Phil Spector era, who had a big hit on a tune called – her name was Darlene Love.
Oh, yeah.
And she had a big hit on a tune, Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry. Mm-hmm. And Phil Spector would call her to the studio to do another Darlene Love record, and she would do the record. And when it came out, it was the Crystals. Her name wasn't on it. She sang back up for everybody. She was the prototypical backup singer, but when she sang lead, she wasn't credited. Hmm. Phil Spector owned those names.
You toured, in addition to being a session musician, you toured for a very long time. And people think that touring, particularly at your level, when you're playing with people and when you yourself are well-known and you're playing with people who are well-known and you're playing for these big venues where everybody comes out, it's got to be exciting and glamorous. And it's not, is it?
No. But I really enjoy it now.
And, now, because you stopped for a long time.
I enjoyed it then. I stopped because it was getting to the point where I wasn't enjoying
right.
it. And the guys that I play with, when I play with them, I have a band, we all agree that we don't get paid for playing. We play for free. We get paid for getting there. And you know, the travel is miserable. when they invent teleportation, it'll be the greatest gig on earth. But they haven't invented it yet, you know. And you have to do sound checks. People think you just come and pick up your instrument and play, but you don't. You have to make sure that the sound is right, not only for the audience, but also for you on stage, so you can do what you do.
And then you play for 2 hours or 3 hours
yeah.
a night, and then you got the other 22 hours of the day
to travel
or do nothing.
I like that idea of doing nothing. I don't know who to propose it to because it doesn't work that way. Because if you're doing nothing, it's costing money.
Yeah.
So as a result, you're always moving or playing. At one time, we used to do gigs for a week or 2 weeks at a time.
Right.
That's back in the Jurassic Age.
When you stopped...
Uh-huh.
You really stopped.
I really did.
You opened a violin repair and retail store with your name on the door in Wilmington, Delaware.
That was after 22 years of not playing.
Oh.
What I did when I stopped was I went to violin making school. And then I spent the next 18 years or so – studying fine old violins so I could identify them. That's the part that I like. I don't handle edge tools since I graduated from school. People bring me instruments and ask me, well, what is it? Mm-hmm. And with violins, what fascinated me about it was how someone could look at the exterior and tell you when and where and sometimes by whom it was made without referring to the little ticket inside, which is very often false. Mm. So that's what I do. I love it.
Wow. What made you get back into the touring end of this and re-recording again after so many years?
When I got to Wilmington, my wife couldn't stand another Chicago winter.
And we have about 30 seconds.
So. Okay. I started some jam sessions and to please the mayor, and I started to enjoy them.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
Glad you're back. He's playing tonight at David Bromberg is playing tonight at the Visual Light Theater beginning at 8, doors open at 7:30 on Elizabeth Avenue. I wanted to play the a cappella part of this, The Strongest Man Alive, but we don't have time. And I wanted to play it because you say you don't like your own voice, but boy, you sing. So thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.